right, welcome to another episode of Piecing It Together, the podcast where we take a look at a new movie and try to figure out what movies inspired it. And today on the show, we are talking about the ninth film from Paul Thomas Anderson. We are, of course, talking about Licorice Pizza, which is finally out in wide release. We actually recorded this episode a month ago, like back before I left for my honeymoon. I got to see it at a early screening. I was lucky enough to see it back then. And guys, spoiler alert for the top 10 of the year episode, but this is going to be my number one by a wide, wide margin. I mean, this is my favorite movie of the year, hands down. And I am so excited to talk about it. Joining me is filmmaker Joe Black. You've heard him on the show a whole bunch in the past. And I know Joe loved this movie as much as I did, and so I was really excited to talk to him about it and really dig into what makes this thing so, so good. So we got that conversation coming up for you here in a second. Before we get to it, I want to remind you, as always, to make sure you're subscribed to Piecing It Together wherever you listen to podcasts. You can rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or Podchaser or Good Pods, and you can follow us on social media at Piecing Pod. Join our Facebook group, Popcorn and Puzzle Pieces, where we continue the conversation about all the movies we talk about here on the show. And it is Christmas when this is going up. If you want to get me a gift, you can leave me a nice little 5-star rating or review. We would really appreciate it if you did that. There's also the Patreon, produced by David Rosen Patreon, where you get bonus and advanced content from Piecing It Together, Awesome Movie Year, from my music career. All kinds of great content over there on the Patreon. You could sign up for that. And we do appreciate all the people that are signed up already. Hopefully 2021 is about to end. 2022 will be the year that I fill that thing with a ton of new content. I am working on 2 new albums at the moment. I have a whole nother album ready to go. Lots of music stuff will be hitting that Patreon next year. And of course, continue to put more and more Piecing It Together, an Awesome Movie, or content on there as well. So check it out. Produced by David Rosen. Patreon.com/ByDavidRosen. And with that said, let's talk about Licorice Pizza. Joe Black is back with us again. How's it going, Joe?
Oh, it's been a while. Been a while. Good to hear your voice.
It sure has. Well, we're going to talk about Licorice Pizza today, and I am very excited to talk about this movie.
I'm honored to be your guest for this episode. I mean that sincerely. So
yeah, I'm a big Paul Thomas Anderson fan. I know you are as well. I mean, who really isn't? But kind of snuck up on me a little bit. I mean, I was looking forward to it because it was his new movie, but at the same time, I don't know if I had quite the expectations going in for what I ended up getting.
Yeah, I would kind of say same. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? If only because this is his most, like, straightforward movie that he's ever made. I don't want to use the word accessible, because that's a bullshit word, like for his work. But it's the most, this is a straightforward movie. There's no guessing, there's no, you know, magical realism, there's no, you know what I mean? It's just, you know, pure bones and wonderful. Just, like, radiates. I got to see it in 70mm. At a guild screening, and I don't know if I could ever see it any other presentation, because
I so wish I could have come out for that. That would be incredible. But this movie, absolutely fantastic. And we will have plenty to talk about as we're going through puzzle pieces and everything. So let's just dive right in, actually, and get to some pieces on this one. What do you have for your first piece?
American Graffiti.
Sure.
And direct reference to American Graffiti, actually, at the beginning of the film, when he's in the bathroom at the very beginning, and then kid runs out of the stall, goes cherry bomb, and the cherry bomb goes off. That's right out of the dance scene from American Graffiti. And also just this, not only like a car culture feeling, but how music is so prominent in both films, and kind of music creates the soundtrack for their childhood. You know, and not just like music on the movie soundtrack, but music that they're listening to, music that they're engaging with, music, you know what I mean? I felt like he really captured that quite beautifully. And like American Graffiti, which although that movie only takes place in one night, and this movie takes place on a timeline that's a little hard to gauge, but it feels very episodic. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not even coming of age as much as it's just a bunch of experiences crammed into one idea. And it was so affecting watching this movie. Yeah. Unlike American Graffiti, which is just a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, American Graffiti is a lot of fun, and a great puzzle piece to kick it off with. And yeah, music really is the thing, I think, that kind of ties together all of our childhoods, really. And so, I mean, it that's what makes it so effective in this. And, you know, that is also why it works so well in my first puzzle piece, which is Almost Famous, Cameron Crowe, which I'm not sure where you fall on that movie, if you like it or not.
I absolutely love that movie.
Okay.
Like, good, love good, it. Good. I think it's, if only Jerry Maguire didn't exist, because if Jerry Maguire didn't exist, it would be his best movie. But unfortunately, that's still Jerry Maguire.
I'm not sure how autobiographical any of Licorice Pizza is for Paul Thomas Anderson, or just maybe the vibe of the era that he grew up in. But, you know, of course, Cameron Crowe's Almost Famous is much more autobiographical, with him landing the job writing for Rolling Stone and following bands around and all that stuff. But again, just the way that music kind of ties together someone's youth is really just a thing that I think we all can relate to, even right now, even though these are everything we've mentioned so far are set in this specific period. And now, you know, we're growing up in a totally different age, but it's still, music is the glue that holds everything together. And these movies really kind of just showcase that.
It reminds me of Boyhood, which I hated, and I don't want to use as a puzzle piece, but the way you're talking about it, Boyhood, the first like 30 minutes of it, the music that would be on the radios and stuff like that Boyhood is set at the time when I was, you know, growing up, you know what I mean?
So yeah,
like,
yeah.
And so the hearing like Blink 182 and Sum 41 and stuff like that just on someone's boombox was very affecting and drew me in for the first 30 minutes of that really long movie.
Very, very much so. By the way, Licorice Pizza, is it mentioned at all in this? Because you've seen it twice now, and I didn't think it was.
No, it's
the
not.
One time I saw it.
It's okay. Not. I saw that interview with him where he talked about that Licorice Pizza was just like, because Licorice Pizza is a record store chain, mostly in malls, mostly in California. And he said that like two words that could just evoke the feeling of that time in his life, or people who grew up in that time in the Valley. Like, and there is a lyricism to it that is just so compelling.
Yeah.
So I
guess for me, it would be Tower Records, but you know,
yeah, it would be
not
for
quite
me, like
the same.
Turtles. I mean, that was the record store that we had. Coconuts was our Jacksonville record store.
And of course, Wax Trax Records, but that would be a little bit too specific to me personally. But.
Dude, I gotta say, I've thought about that place every day since I went, and I'm highly enjoying my Ani Kuni 45 nice. That you guys got for me. We gotta utilize that spot, man. We gotta film in there or something. Like let's make a high fidelity for the podcast generation in that place.
What do you got next?
Okay, next one I have is The Graduate.
Okay.
But not in the way that I think people will think that I'm thinking. I said that right. Ben Braddock in The Graduate, Dustin Hoffman's character. You've seen it, correct?
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, he's this guy who he's just completed college, and he's like trying to figure out something's not right about his life, and he's trying to find his place and all that kind of stuff. And I thought that was very similar to the main girl in Licorice Pizza. I thought that she was very, I thought that she was kind of in a similar spot. Like, the school years are done. She's 26, so she claims. I think she's older. I think that when she says she's 28, that's like a slip up. You know what I mean? That like, oh fuck, I just said my real age, you know? but so she's very similar to me as Ben Braddock, in this movie, but she meets this kid, Gary, who's only like, you know, 15 years old when she meets him. And like right out of the gate, like there's something fascinating about this. Well, to be totally honest about what he is, he's a fucking child. You know what I mean? But she's drawn to him. She kind of has, she has the same feeling about him that he has right out of the gate, that like, oh, he's going to be important to me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? For the rest of my life too. Cause I'm one of those saps that believes at the end when they're like, this is, you know, I'm going to marry that girl and blah, blah, blah. I believe that. Yep. That's movies. They're going to be together forever. Yeah. Spoilers, but Ben Braddock, my take when I saw The Graduate, which I did not see until I was 27 years old, was 29 years old. I just pulled in Alana Haim. was that the minute he meets Catherine Ross's character, he loves her instantly. You know, he's banging Mrs. Robinson or whatever, and like he doesn't want to mess that up, you know. But then he meets her daughter and they're forced to go on a date, and the second he sees her, I think he's like, shit. Yeah. She's gonna be the one. So he does everything he can to like repel her at first. He's like wearing the sunglasses, being an asshole, takes her to a strip club, but he like hates himself for it because he knows he's pushing away destiny. And then when she runs out of the fucking club, which is the whiskey, he chases after her. And the rest of the movie, he's just like, no, like, and she knows it too. It's why the ending of the movie isn't creepy. Why it's not like he's stalking her or anything like that when he's following her at the zoo and all that. It's because, no, we're supposed to fucking be together. The end.
Right.
Like, period.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's we, not I think, not you think. No, no, we are, that's it. Yeah. And that's how I felt about her in this movie too, where it's just like this constant denial because she doesn't want it to be true because she doesn't feel like a complete whole yet. But what she doesn't realize is what makes them each a complete whole is each other. You know what I mean? And they're young and their children are growing. And that's what marriage, as you know, is a bond. It's a rope. It's two strands coming together to form a tighter rope, you know, like a stronger rope. And so The Graduate. Also a banging soundtrack.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting, this movie, you know, we're talking about it now before it has come out and even in limited release. You got to see it out there, one of those 70 millimeter screenings, but it's coming out limited release Thanksgiving. This episode will go up when it comes out in wide release, which is Christmas. It'll be interesting to see how people react to a romance between basically a 15-year-old and a 25-year-old in this movie. I have a feeling it's not going to be so cut and dry, even with this being just such a kind of perfect and realistic romance of two people and the way that things kind of go sometimes.
I disagree, actually. I think it will go over very well.
You think nobody is going to have a problem with it?
Well, of course, the word nobody is an impossibility. But I think that the consensus will, because what he does better, what Paul Thomas Anderson does better than anything else in this movie, which he does everything pretty on the money, is that he convinces you of the same thing right out of the gate. You know, that they're supposed to be together. It's just what happens. You know what I mean? He makes you believe in love again. I know it sounds so cheesy.
I get it, though. I get it, though. I mean, I said in my Letterboxd review, like, I started smiling at the beginning of this movie and just did not stop the whole time. I mean, my face hurt by the end.
Absolutely. And that opening shot, this only happens very rarely in movies. And but, like, the very opening shot, the way it's choreographed, the way it's written, the way it's performed, and the Nina Simone music underneath, like, all of the above, the opening shot, I was like, we're in good hands. We're fine. This movie will be good. I can feel it right out of the gate that he has a reason for what he's doing and he's firing at all cylinders.
Yeah. Well, I'll go to my next piece, which I'm sure The Graduate was a puzzle piece for, and that is Wes Anderson's Rushmore. I would say the Max Fisher character played by Jason Schwartzman, just the sheer oozing of confidence and just knowing everything and just putting that on everybody else. I think the Gary Valentine character here, as played by Cooper Hoffman, is kind of the embodiment of that, although a likable version, whereas Max Fisher is kind of a shit. I think Cooper Hoffman creates this character that is just absolutely lovable, even though he is kind of a shit, but he's just great, you know? And I think also just to add on to this, aside from Rushmore, I would maybe add a little bit of Moonrise Kingdom in there as well, which I don't love as much as a lot of other people as far as Wes Anderson movies go, but just the capturing of that feeling of kids kind of trying to be adult and trying to grow up without any adults around to figure out what that means and how to do that. And so I think there's a little bit of Moonrise Kingdom in there as well.
Moonrise Kingdom was the canary in the coal mine as far as I was concerned, because everything since has just been a fucking natural disaster. But Rushmore, that was one of my pieces too. I mean, it's inevitable.
Okay.
But, you know, it's really funny, David, when that movie came out, Rushmore, I mean, so many people, grown-ups that I knew, my uncle especially, they were all like, that Max Fisher reminds me of you. And like, I you know, I love that movie. When I was a teenager, Max Fisher was kind of my hero because he was willing to be as selfish. He was willing to be more selfish than I could ever be. You know what I mean? Like, I'm very determined and I'm kind of all over the map, and I'm terrible at school, but teachers loved me, just like him, you know. But
nice.
But like, I was never afraid to ask things of people or try to convince people of something, but I never would dare to encroach on people's boundaries, on their boundaries the way that he did. But
maybe not sneak into a window or anything like that.
Well, see, that's another one of those things that, like, I listened to your guys' Awesome Movie Year. It was the first time I ever listened to Awesome Movie Year, in fact. I was driving, and it made me so upset that I don't think I'm going to listen to Awesome Movie Year anymore for a minute. Like, I'll go back to it one day, because, like, the take on Max Fisher is so, as far as I'm concerned, and obviously I'm coming from, is so wrong on that episode, that Jason was a little more in the money, that he's a child, right? He is a child. And the people who need to be taking responsibility in that film are the adults. And especially the scene where he goes in through the window, she knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
She knows from minute one what he feels for her. And she's frustrated with herself because she knows that it's wrong and bad for her. But like, she says, you remind me of my husband, you know, but we know that that's not a good thing because her husband doesn't seem like he was the best for her either, really, in a way.
Sure.
So when he comes to her window and she knows what's going on, and when he kisses her, it's too real. Like, it's like, I can't. She wants to entertain that. She wants to be loved by him. She wants to be idolized by somebody who reminds her of her husband. That's what she wants.
Yeah.
And I don't like
Josh's take.
Josh. I really didn't appreciate, because he started going in a direction and then he turned and just started, he's a bad person. No, he's a child who says something's not right.
Well, it's pretty established that Josh hates kids, so.
That's fair. Yeah, that's totally fair. And I don't know Josh at all. I know Jason a little, like we've talked a little bit, you know what I mean? So like, but Gary in this movie, it's funny, the day before I went to go see this movie, my friend Damon Packard, who's a great filmmaker, you guys should check out his work, Damon Packard, Reflections of Evil, Fatal Pulse, this guy's kooky, like he's amazing. But he saw it the day before me and he texted me, he's like, the main kid in this reminded me of you. I kind of thought the movie was a bit dull. And I'm like, son of a bitch. but Gary, honestly, as an adult and watching it now, like I really did see myself in Gary more than I did Max Fisher, even when I was younger, because he doesn't ever cross that line. You know what I mean? But unlike Gary, I was always focused on movies. Like it was always film, whether it was acting or being in them. That was the only discrepancy. You know what I mean? But it was always film. And my heart went out to Gary that he's so desperately searching for the outlet. You know what I mean? And I think that that's what Rushmore and this movie have more in common, even than just the character themselves, is that that character's goal is they're looking for what makes the most sense. This is the human version. Rushmore is the eccentric version. And I think they're both equally successful.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what do you got for your next piece?
Well, that was my another piece, but here, we'll move right on to, this is a little bit of a weird one. Vincent Gallo's debut film, Buffalo 66.
Okay.
Have you ever seen this film?
I saw it once a long time ago,
Oh, man, lucky you that one time, because it's great. That's one of those, you know, you look back on a lot of movies you discovered when you're like 13 or 14 that were like indie movies, and you look at them now and you're just like, oh, my God. You know, like, I can't believe I liked this fucking I Heart Huckabees. Oh, my Lord. But Buffalo
66,
me too. I mean, let's be honest, but Buffalo 66 is one of those movies that like, almost like Kevin Smith's Clerks. Like if I saw that movie for the first time, you know, in my 30s, I would be like, wow, what a beautiful groundbreaking film. You know what I mean? It's about a, for those of you who don't know, it is about a man who gets out of prison, and kidnaps a tap dancer played by Christina Ricci. And he tells her that he's going over to have dinner with his parents and they don't know he's in prison. They think he's in the FBI and she's going to pretend to be his wife. So he's holding her hostage. But of course, she like falls in love with him and then goes on along with him on his journey to kill the man who put him in prison or who got him put in prison. He made a bad bet on a, you know, whatever. I bring this up as a piece for two reasons. One, because like we're talking about, it's kind of a controversial idea for a romance to be born out of.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Yeah. She gets kidnapped by this guy who like, you know, his threat to her is so funny. When he's talking about being with his parents, he's like, if you do this for me, I'll be your best friend. But if you fuck this up, I will never talk to you ever again. Like, It's so good. But a lot of people, like, it's abusive, it's blah, 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 it, you know. And yes, if you're looking at it from a place of judgment, but, you know, people are just people. And that movie is a controversial romance that ends in happiness.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest surprise of Buffalo 66, because it's a dark movie, it's really sad. The main character is dark and sad, you know, Vincent Gallo's character. And at the end of the movie, instead of, spoilers, instead of choosing to kill this guy, he literally, at a strip club, no less, where the guy is, he just walks across the street to a fucking cookie store. Mm. And he buys a bunch of cookies. He spends all the money he has left on cookies, and he gets one specifically that looks like a heart. He's like, whose idea was it for the heart cookie? And the old man behind him, that was mine. And he's like, oh, that's nice. That's, you know. And the movie ends with him going home and choosing her instead, and them holding each other in their arms in a hotel bed as Sweetness by Yes plays, which is like the cheesiest song of all time. And that such an indie, dark, you know, blah, 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 ends in such bleeding heart romantic love. That's how I felt about the end of Licorice Pizza, you know? Like when they embrace at the end, and then he says, I'm for the future, you know, Alana Hart. And she's like, oh, you son of a bitch, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I was worried that they were going to end on that line, because I was like, oh, I mean, it's cute, but it's a little cynical, you know? Mm-hmm. But then, no, they cut to outside and then running in slow motion. I love you, Gary. Oh, yeah. So good.
So good. Absolutely great ending. And yeah, I need to revisit Buffalo 66. I remember really liking it at the time, and it's I think it's more than enough time since the last time I got to watch it again.
Best trailer of all time too, man. The
really? I don't know if I've ever seen the trailer.
The trailer is just 2 minutes of stills from the movie cut to House of the Sunrise Heart of the Sunrise by Yes.
Okay.
It's so rad. I'll send you a link.
That's awesome. Okay, well, speaking of romances, this is about as mainstream as you can get, but I thought of The Notebook from Nick Cassavetes, Nicholas Sparks. But just the way that Gary and Alana are never in a right place for each other throughout the whole movie, and just back and forth, there's always something in the way of them being together until the end, you know? And, you know, this goes on to the very, very end, The Notebook, of course, but here we just get that little snapshot, but similar trajectory for their romance.
David, you're talking my language now. The Notebook, I am madly in love with that movie. It was the film that introduced me to Jenna Rollins as an actress, who as people who may have listened to this or know me know that Jenna Rollins and her husband John Cassavetes are the two most important artists in my life. And I did get to work with her eventually one day, which was the greatest honor of my life still.
Amazing.
Yeah, it really was like, you know, it's the biggest, the greatest career or artistic honor of my life. The Notebook is a masterpiece. Like The Notebook,
it's great.
It's a movie that, it's a movie that gets criticized because of all the other movies like it.
Right.
And I felt that similarly about Jason Reitman's new Ghostbusters too, that like a lot of the criticism comes from all the other nostalgia cash grabs. You know what I mean? The Notebook is hurt because people just loop it in with every other cheesy romance movie. But yeah, that movie is so true. And it's such a movie. I mean, them going through with the swans and on the rowboat. Like, I mean, I have a fun memory to share. You can cut this if you'd like, but it's a fun memory for me. I put it on one random Tuesday night at like midnight in my apartment. Mm. My buddy Will, as soon as the movie's starting, the opening credits are starting, Will just walks into my apartment. He lived in the apartment across from mine. And he's like, I brought you some McDonald's. What's this? And I was like, this is a Notebook. And he's like, oh, I heard of this. And he tosses me a McDouble and he sits down on the couch behind me. And we don't say another word till the end of the movie. And when the movie is over, it's like 3 a.m. I look to him and he goes, that was real good. And I was like, wasn't it?
That's sweet.
Yeah.
That is very sweet.
Yeah. Good piece. Oh.
Awesome. Well, what do you got next?
You know, I mean, this is so odd for me because usually I'm just so loaded with pieces, but I only have one more off the top of my head, which is... oh boy, it's Woody Allen's 1979 masterpiece, Manhattan. Mm. Have you ever seen it?
Again, it's been a long time. I watched my entire Woody Allen box set, probably around 2021 or something like that, but I haven't seen that one in a long time.
Wow. You have a box set. That's fun. I wonder what ones are in that box set. Yeah. Yes. I mean, we'll it's hard not to talk about the real life controversy, let alone in regard to Manhattan, where Woody Allen plays a 42-year-old in a relationship with a 17-year-old.
Yeah.
That being said, it is my favorite Woody Allen movie. I think it's one of the best romances ever put on screen. And Rebecca Hall at one point claimed it was her favorite movie of all time, which
should watch that together sometime.
That's a great idea. Let her know for me. When it came out, it was not really his follow up to Annie Hall, but it was, because he made a movie in between, a movie called Interiors that nobody saw and the people who did didn't like. But Manhattan was a blockbuster, mega smash hit, nominated for every award under the sun, didn't win any. It lost Best Picture to Kramer versus fucking Kramer, which is a good movie, but I mean, come on. But it's a film where he's dating a 17-year-old who he doesn't take seriously, and he has a best friend who is having an affair with this woman. And when Woody meets that woman, he falls in love with her. So he drops the 17-year-old to be in a relationship with the woman his friend was having an affair with, Diane Keaton. And he thinks, he even says this, she's a basket case, Diane Keaton. And he says at one point, every guy thinks that they're going to be the one to change her. You know what I mean? She ends up betraying him by dating his friend again. And then his friend decides he's going to leave his wife and they're going to run away together. It's like a whole complicated mess. And the end of the movie is Woody Allen's character alone talking about, into a tape recorder, about all the things that make life worth living. And he specifically remembers that girl, the 17-year-old, Tracy. He's like Tracy's face or Tracy's smile. And he has a sentimental moment with a gift she gave him, a harmonica. And he runs across Manhattan to be with her, much like in Licorice Pizza. When he gets there, she's leaving the country. She's literally on her way out the door to go to England for 6 months as part of an acting thing. And she's 18 now. And he says to her, you know, I've realized like I was wrong. I should have taken you seriously. I love you so much. And she's like, well, great. Like, let's, you know, when I get back, let's pick it back up where we left off. And he's like, what are you talking about? No, just don't go. Like, what do you mean? Yeah. Like 6 months. 6 months is forever. And she says, like, you know, 6 months isn't so long. You just have to have a little faith in people. And the movie ends with his like this shot of Woody Allen where he like knows how the real world works. But that's kind of what he loves about her in general, is that she doesn't. So that's the note that the movie ends on. And, you know, I don't want to get into the whole controversy thing, because like the movie actually clearly explains what it is about her that he's so in love with, and what it is about like a mentor relationship that appeals to him and whatever. But like this movie, I think that it is that similar controversy of the age thing. And I'd be curious to see if you're right, if it becomes like a thing that people comment on, because, you know, it would be interesting to explore the idea of a double standard of, if the woman is older, does that change things?
Right.
You know what I mean? Does that shift the perspective? That'd be an interesting thing to see unfold in a social kind of commentary kind of way, like a communication. But what I love about the ending of Manhattan is the antithesis of the end of this movie. But the movie lover in me loves the end of this movie, where it's like, nope, they're together forever. It's magical movie ending, like, you know, Alana Hart and I Love You, Gary, as they run in slow motion. You know what I mean? So it's really interesting that they diverge at the very last second, but I love them both equally.
Yeah, I do think that the optimism of whether or not they're going to be together forever in this, I think it the movie gives you that. If you maybe didn't have it going into it, because normally I would think like they're not going to, because that's the way life works. You know what I mean? It's just like this one great, you know, memory that these people would end up having. But no, the movie makes you want to believe that.
Yeah, and I think that your piece of The Notebook is very telling. That like The Notebook came to mind, when The Notebook is the most romantic movie like ever made, so much so that the two characters literally die together the same night, holding each other in an old folks home. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like that, so like it really does channel that romantic inside of you. And I think that that ending is so beautifully cinematic because it reminds you of like movies are a way to get things right.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, and this movie captures that better than seriously than any movie I can think of in recent memory. Like truly, like I can't remember the last time a movie so perfectly captured that idea and feeling and made it truthful. You know, I think this is, you know, me, Inherent Vice is my favorite Paul Thomas Anderson movie. It's nowhere near his best, but it's my favorite. I think this is the best movie Paul Thomas Anderson has made since Magnolia, if not since Boogie Nights, even. You know what I mean? This is, and it's interesting that it's a movie about children, because he always seems to kind of gravitate more toward characters who are kind of children. You know what I mean? Like whether it's Dirk Diggler or all of Magnolia is about children in a way. And that's why I hated Phantom Thread so much, because like I felt it kind of tipped over into like, this guy needs to grow the fuck up and stop abusing people. And he won't, you know, like, but this, I think that he really found, he really hit it on the head with this one. And I think it's a masterpiece.
So I got two more pieces here, they both are on kind of different ends of where this movie goes. I'll go with one first that we haven't even really talked about much. That's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Quentin Tarantino's last movie. Just the love letter to Hollywood of a very specific era and everything that comes along with that. And, you know, we haven't really gotten into like any of the little side characters and stuff like that. Sean Penn and Bradley Cooper and all these people who are either actual Hollywood people or people that are just based on them. And just all of the adventures that the main characters get into through their interactions with these people. And, you know, they're very different movies, but they both do celebrate that particular moment of Hollywood. And they have like a real reverence for all those real parts of Hollywood.
Yeah. I it's funny when I saw, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I actually thought of it as not only a companion piece, but almost a response to Inherent Vice.
Yeah.
Like they seemed like two movies that worked together, like on purpose, you know what I mean? And this movie, I did feel that same thing for the reasons you just mentioned, you know, but also just in what they're saying, you know what I mean? Like, I think that like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is a movie about the romance. Inherent Vice is a movie about how the romance died. And then Licorice Pizza is a movie about how the romance is reborn, you know, from the true Hollywood, which is the Valley. Yeah. Because that's where all the movies in Hollywood get made. You know what I mean? So, like, I think that they work beautifully as a trilogy in that way. And yes, all the little, like, Bradley Cooper, if ever somebody deserved an Oscar for 5 minutes of screen time, it's him in this movie.
He's so goddamn good.
He would have been good to play Jared Leto's character in House of Gucci. Mm. Like, he knows how to embody the silliness of John Peters, play it to a 10, but also be a human being. You know,
another thing that kind of leans into this, and we don't have to get like too much into it, but part of what I feel connects these two also is some of the rougher edges of what that era of Hollywood are. And that includes John Peters being this, you know, kind of sex pest kind of character, you know, includes, of course, again, the 15-25-year-old romance, which, I mean, we look at now as a problem. Back then, most people probably wouldn't have even batted an eye at something like that. Right. And then also John Michael Higgins' character with the like insanely racist, you know, stereotypical voice. I mean, these are things that were characters at this point in time.
Yeah, you know, he's so good in this movie, John Michael Higgins.
He's so good.
When Tom Waits popped up on, I mean, obviously, you know, my Tom Waits tattoo would lead everybody to understand that when I saw him in the trailer, that's all I could think about afterward.
Sure.
When he popped up at like the exact halfway point of this movie, I like grabbed my heart with excitement. Like I was so excited. And then immediately after I did it, Tom Waits in the movie did the same thing.
Yeah, he does the.
Yeah, I was like, oh my God, that was to me. Who's Sean Penn? What are you talking about? But I think that, and then you got like Lucille Ball at the beginning, but going under, it's interesting that he chose to like, he does the antithesis, he does the opposite of what Tarantino did, which Tarantino like tied his movie, his fiction into the reality of Hollywood. You know what I mean? He kind of, PTA takes the reality of Hollywood and puts it through a fictional lens, because the woman's name is Lucy, but it's like Lucy something else. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
And it's interesting that he kept John Peters.
Right, yeah.
But, I mean, I'm fine with that, because John Peters gave us one of the greatest films of all time. Another awesome movie year episode that I will not listen to because I know that they didn't like it. Wild Wild West. Okay, maybe admittedly I listened to a little bit of it, but I just, it hurt so much. John,
hey, if nothing else, at least it got me to finally watch it, right?
Oh, man, you are so lucky to see that movie as an adult. Like, for the, it was your first time?
It was my first time. God, I missed it when it first came out.
God bless you. That to me is a perfect film. Like, that's not perfect. The cross-dressing scene is not good. But but I actually use that scene as an example for a bunch of movies that are, like, radically out there, that people don't like. I always reference, like, it has a Wild Wild West scene in it, which is, Wild Wild West is such a weird, crazy movie that, like, you're walking this fine line the whole time, like, is this on purpose? What are they doing? You know, if you're, like, just a, you know, average film watcher. And then there's one scene in it that's terrible. And it's that cross-dressing scene. So that one scene tips you off of the fine line into a scale of, this all sucks. If that scene wasn't in there, I think people would have loved the movie. And there's a lot of movies that have that scene in it. But anyways, back to John Peters. He's in there. I think that I read Sean Penn is supposed to be kind of like a William Holden kind of character. And I think that that kind of works in a way. One problem I have with Tarantino's book of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which I read, which is very good. It's good. But it gets a little, like, Ready Player One-y, where it just becomes, like, I get it, dude. You know a lot about that, and you like it. Like, you know, like, yeah, 60s TV actors, cool. Can you tell me a story? The movie doesn't do that, but the book does that. But maybe that's why PTA did this, like, to not distract from it. You know what I mean? Like, not distract from, and also, you don't want to get sold as that kind of movie either. You don't want to be sold as, like, the movie that has, like, you know, like, when the trailers come up, you know, like, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is all about Sharon Tate and Charles Manson. Right. And, you know, it's like, you don't want that to happen. You don't want people to go expecting, like, ooh, I'm going to see, you know.
So this is about the main two characters, and that's what matters with this movie. But yeah, my last piece then would not be a movie, but basically American romantic rock songs, basically, like anything like a Tom Petty song, or even like a John Mellencamp, Jack and Diane, you know, something like that. Just anything where you're getting these broad brushstrokes of a relationship, just some of the best parts within the verses, you know, and you're not getting the whole story. You're not getting the whole life of these people, whether or not they actually ended up together or anything like that. You're just getting these memories of two people that are in love, that are falling in love. And that, I think, kind of ties into the whole licorice pizza theme of the title.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more, actually. It's interesting that, like, a movie, you know, we talked about movies fueled by music earlier, and, like, I mentioned Boyhood, but, like, Dazed and Confused is another movie like that. But what's interesting about Dazed and Confused is that it's a movie that uses every top 40 hit. You know what I mean? It's like the radio version of what you're talking about.
Right.
And it's interesting with you just talking about it right now, what you just made me kind of, like, swirl in my head is that this movie is called Licorice Pizza, which it's almost like these are the albums that you invest in. You know what I mean? It's about albums more than it's about the radio, if you will.
Sure.
And the music in this movie is not, it's not like hits that you think of all the time. It's not, you know what I mean? What you just stirred up in my mind makes me appreciate the movie even more. That it's about how personal music can be, as opposed to how universal music can actually be, in a way.
From both ends, from listening to it and from writing it, from the songwriting perspective.
Interesting.
As well.
Yes, yes, yes. Like, like, maybe, like, why Against All Odds, you know, by Phil Collins, like, when you hear that song, you know that he, like, went through that.
Right.
You know
what
I mean? Like that he had that experience, you know, versus something that's written by, you know, 20 different writers now. And, like,
sure.
I will say this, though, the Life on Mars drop in the movie, as good as it goes with the images of them running down the row of parked cars, it was the one time in the movie that it felt like a little too needle droppy. Like that was the one time where I went, eh, there sure is a lot of music, you know, dropping in this movie. And I applaud him for thinking that he can outdo the Life on Mars cue in Life Aquatic. because that is one of the best music cues of any movie ever, when Bill Murray like, excuse me for a second, and cuts to the crescendo as he walks to the edge of his boat and just takes one slow motion hit as the chorus ends, and then goes back to Ned. Sorry about that, man. You caught me with one foot off the merry-go-round. but yeah, that's, it's interesting. I think your piece that you just said actually completely changed my whole perspective of my first piece of American Graffiti, because American Graffiti is car radio culture. It's a communal culture thing. And I actually think what you just tapped into is that, no, this is a more personal connection with the memories and with the art that fueled who you are as an adult from your childhood. That's a really lovely piece, David.
Well, I'm glad we brought that one full circle there with American Graffiti, with our first piece of the conversation. So,
well, we forgot to mention too, when we talk about Rushmore, that was Jason Schwartzman's first movie. And
that's true.
The two leads in this, I think they're equally, I think that she's a bit more like, he's still a little green. You know what I mean? And maybe it's because she's performed for so long.
Yeah,
like she's a little more at ease. I think he can amp it up just a little. He can give us just a little more, you know. But the movie doesn't work if they don't work, and they work. Like their performances are wonderful.
They're just wonderful. They're just amazing to watch. I really Paul Thomas Anderson has been saying in interviews that he hopes to work with them again, you know, and I just hope they continue to work. I hope that. This isn't just like just a flash in the pan thing where like, oh, they got to act in a Paul Thomas Anderson movie and that's the end of it. You know, I hope we see them again.
Yeah, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. This movie, like even just talking about it now, has got me so excited and like so stirred up that I even forgot to mention in my long-winded Graduate thing that the ending of The Graduate, people always read as like, oh, what are we going to do now? Oh, fuck, the future's ahead of us. You know, did we just make a mistake is what people read it as. Like, oh, did we just do the right thing? But I had a different read when I saw it as an adult, and I didn't know about, like, the ending contextually or anything. I felt the ending was like, oh, fuck, now we got to take on the real world together. Like, I look at the ending of The Graduate as they did the right thing and they know it, but now, like, now that that's out of the way, the hard part begins, which is making a life. Like, you know what I mean? I think that Ben and Elaine are going to be together forever at the end of that movie. I really do. I don't read that as like, did we just make the right decision? I read that as like, oh, great. Now we have to pave the path for ourselves.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well,
I don't know.
I'm going to read down the finished puzzle here, and then we'll get into some closing thoughts here. There's a couple of things I wanted to bring up still. But the finished puzzle includes American Graffiti, Almost Famous, The Graduate, Rushmore, and Moonrise Kingdom. Buffalo 66, The Notebook, Manhattan, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and American Love Rock Songs. We talked about a few of them in there. But, you know, one thing that I really love in this that we didn't really get into in any of the puzzle pieces, but it just kind of goes to Gary's personality, is how he's constantly starting new businesses throughout the run of the movie. I just think that's so much fun. I couldn't really think of like a puzzle piece to apply to that. That's why I just wanted to bring it up now. But I just think that's such a fun character thing to like, you know, he's selling water beds. He's got a pinball arcade. He's, you know, doing all these things. Yeah. And it's just, I don't know. It's just an interesting character thing. And I don't know if is there another movie you could think of that something like that applies
to? Well, honestly, Rushmore, because the whole thing is he's always coming up with the new clubs and like,
with the clubs. You know what I mean? Yeah. So yeah. I guess that applies again back to Max Fisher a little bit.
Well, and I like the way that Gary works. I think that's what I related to the most. I've made 14 features, right? Like feature length movies. And most people who I know haven't even seen them, but they're always like, man, I can't, just, how do you even do it? How do you make them happen? You know? And I describe to people, it's like being in a cartoon and you're running and you run off of a cliff, right? Yeah. And you keep running in the air, but you only fall when you like stop and look down.
Right.
You know what I mean? So like, that's kind of the, the attitude you have to go in with, you know, once a ball keeps rolling, like it has to keep rolling. Otherwise it's going to stop, you know?
Yeah.
And that's kind of Gary. Gary will see everything all the way through. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, and he goes hard. Like, you know what I mean? Cause the second you like take a break from it or move on, you know, like, or try something, like it all falls apart. You know what I mean? And I really loved that spirit of this movie too.
Yeah, spirit's a good word for it.
Oh,
for
we could have said Taxi Driver, because how could you not think of Taxi Driver when she starts working at the just as a random, when she starts working for the
Benny Safdie character,
and there's that creepy guy across the way, and like the guy who she's working with, who obviously loved him. I was worried that the movie was going to take me in that direction, like, which is kind of what I meant about the Buffalo 66 piece too, where I was like, oh God, is this going to be a thing where this guy comes in and like shoots up the place and kills her, or like,
right,
you know what I mean? Like, don't do it. Don't go there. And then the movie at the end is like, what the fuck are you talking about? Of course I wasn't going to go there. Fuck you.
It's funny that we would think that, cause I thought the same thing. And I mean, not that it's not obvious to think that, but like Paul Thomas Anderson, you would kind of especially think it, you know, to kind of like zig in a weird direction like that, and you know, a dark direction. But yeah, he had absolutely no intention of taking us anywhere like that with this movie.
God love him for it. Like, you know, I do love him, as you mentioned at the beginning of this thing. Like, I really do love him. But that being said, I don't think he's perfect by any means. I actually really don't like There Will Be Blood. I really don't like The Master, and I really hate Phantom Thread. But and as much as I love Inherent Vice, it doesn't work, quote unquote. But what I love about him is that he's a filmmaker who's coming from a place of soul, and he speaks the cinematic language so fluently that he's searching for a way to do it that's more meaningful than what we quote unquote expect. Yeah. And sometimes when that perspective becomes an agenda, and that's when he gets into trouble as a filmmaker, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. But when you keep that as your perspective, like Licorice Pizza, you can't go wrong. So like some of his best films, like Hard Eight and Magnolia and Boogie Nights and even Punch Drunk Love, like those are the movies that work the best because he's being true to himself, not true to his intentions, or not true to his, not true to his agenda. You know what I mean? And this movie about children shows, in my opinion, a great maturation in him as a filmmaker.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and at the very least a good reminder so that if he goes back to doing more experimental stuff, they're like, no, he's got it. You know what I mean?
Right.
And we need to match him on that level when we see his work. So.
For sure. Well, I think that does it for Licorice Pizza. Joe, is there another movie you watched recently you'd like to recommend to our listeners?
Yes. Keeping with the music theme, I just saw a 1978 Vietnam drug run thriller called Who'll Stop the Rain, based on the CCR song. And it's got Nick Nolte in it and Tuesday Weld's. And it's about a this like artist playwright who got drafted in Vietnam, went crazy over there because of all the horrible, ugly things. And he decides he's going to like make a form of protest by drug running. Like he's kind of snapped his mind. So he's going to run drugs out of, and he recruits his buddy who's just getting out of the army, played by Nick Nolte, to bring the drugs in for him and drop them off. But Nick Nolte knows it's a terrible idea. And of course gets caught up in like this, it of course goes wrong. And Nick Nolte ends up with the playwright's wife on the run from the killers and from like crooked cops. And, you know, it's very, it reminded me a lot. It's like a Rambo, you know, like First Blood meets True Romance. If you could mesh those two movies together in your mind.
Well, that sounds good.
Yeah. It's on Tubi. Apparently I saw it, in a cool little private screening. But it's on Tubi. If anybody wants to check it out, it's really rad. And Nick Nolte, you sometimes forget because of all that's happened, you forget what an incredible, not only actor he is, but he was a fucking movie star. You know what I mean? Like he was born to be in front of a camera. So
awesome. Well, Joe, why don't you tell people about what you got going on with your films? And by the way, at the time that this goes up, your screening here in Las Vegas will have already happened. But for anybody who happens to hear this on the Patreon, maybe let them know about the screening.
We had a screening that you all missed, and it went great. Yeah. It was sold out anyway.
Or so is happening in the future if you're on the Patreon.
So you couldn't have gotten in. But we're doing another screening in Denver, Colorado, right after Christmas at a little theater in Denver. Before we're going to my wife's family. My wife is from the Denver area, so we're going up there for Christmas and all of her friends and family. So there's that screening, and then we're just waiting to hear back. Every festival that we've entered in, I've never done the festival thing before, so we've entered into like 20 festivals, and you hear back from all of them in like January.
Yeah.
So like we're about to get like a hailstorm of like rejection, but maybe one or two little blips of like, for real, you really like us?
That's how it goes.
So, and we're also trying to work now on getting some kind of like distribution deal for it. I've never distributed any of my movies before. If you want to see any of my other films, you can see them on my website, bluemeanspregnantfilms.com. They're all on there for free to watch. You know, they're just Vimeo links. But this one, we're actually going to try to like, I hate thinking of my movies as products, but like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't like that idea. Because I don't want to make movies to make money. I want money to make movies.
Mm.
You know, but I'm slowly learning how to accept that in my life without allowing it to corrupt me. Yeah. You know,
you got to think a little more like John Peters, Joe.
If I thought like John Peters, I mean, that motherfucker was like Superman, of course, Batman, of course, Wild Wild West is the natural progression, and. As far as I'm concerned, he's right. I mean, I like each one of those movies more than the last one. So,
yeah.
His first movie was The Main Event, right? With Barbra Streisand, the boxing movie.
Yeah.
So, just think of that. One of the most powerful producers in the history of this industry. That was his first idea.
Yeah.
Where he's like, "You know what? You know what I'm thinking? We put some gloves on Barb, on Baps, and get her sparring."
Amazing. Well, Joe, thanks so much as always for joining me on the show, and I always look forward to getting you back on here.
I love being on here. Thank you so much.
Come on, everybody. Hi, this is Wax Trax Records here on 2909 South Decatur. We buy all your old 45s, your old albums, any type of music memorabilia. Also, we sell music memorabilia, albums, CDs, and a lot. Come on down to Wax Trax, 2909 South Decatur, or give me a call at 702-362-4300. Thank you very much.
All right, so I hope you enjoyed that conversation about Licorice Pizza. Thanks, as always, to Joe Black for joining me on the episode, and thank you so much for listening. And by the way, I realized while I was editing this that I brought up last week on the show Buffalo 66 from Vincent Gallo, and on this episode, which, like I said, we had recorded like a month ago, Joe brought up Vincent Gallo's Buffalo 66. I guess I had that on my mind at the time when we were recording the Red Rocket episode. But anyway, I should rewatch that movie one of these days. Well, as always, I want to remind you all to make sure you're subscribed to Piecing It Together wherever you listen to podcasts. You can, of course, do that on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, Pocket Cast, Good Pods. All the places you can listen to podcasts, you can subscribe, and we have a lot of episodes coming your way, including our end-of-the-year things like the top 10 of the year, like Josh Bell is going to join me, Josh Bell from Awesome Movie Year, to talk about our top 10 movies, older movies that we watched for the first time in 2021. That's going to be another special episode. We started that last year, and we're going to do it again this year. And of course, you know, we got The Matrix coming up, we got Spider-Man, we got all this stuff. So lots of Piecing It Together coming your way, so make sure you're subscribed. And while you're at it, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or Podchaser or Good Pods. We really appreciate the ratings and the reviews. And it is the holidays, so, you know, it's a great little gift for me if you enjoy what I do here on the show. Leave a little 5-star rating. That would be really nice. You could also follow us on social media at Piecing Pod. Join the Facebook group Popcorn and Puzzle Pieces. Check out that Patreon I told you about at the top of the show, the Produced by David Rosen Patreon. And, you know, share the show. Get in touch. Let me know what you think of it. Next year, there's like a lot of movies coming out. So get in touch if you want to maybe join me for an episode. That would be cool too. I love hearing from people who enjoy the show and who want to join me for future episodes. So definitely get in touch. So that does it. Let's close this thing out with a piece of music like I always do. This is kind of a tough one for me to find a piece of music for. I'm not sure, since I don't make anything that even sleeps anywhere near like 70s rock. I don't know what of my tracks to play, but I think I'm going to go with a track from my soundtrack album, Beater, original motion picture soundtrack that I put out last year, which is a compilation of a feature film called Beater, the score from that, as well as some scores from short films that I worked on with the same director, Chris Johnson. This is from one of those short films, one called To Cherish the Time, and this is a track called Memories of a Time. So I'm going to play this track. I think it'll be a nice one to close us out with. So this is Memories of a Time from my album Beater, original motion picture soundtrack, and we'll be back with more Piecing It Together real soon. Thank you.
an All Points West production, produced by David Rosen in Las Vegas.